Hi, this is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we're offering five conversations from episode 11, in which Michael Charlton joins Jorn, Louise, and me for a far-ranging conversation of recent studies and highlights. Plus, from the vault, a conversation from last year's EASL Congress wrap-up, offering some different thoughts about the role of MASH drugs as adjuvant therapies. Like the two previous conversations, this one is a bit of a grab bag of end of the hot topics discussion, followed by Michael Charlton discussing issues and excitement around the FGF 21 class. As the conversation begins, Louise Campbell and Jorn Schottenberg are speculating on ways to incorporate metrics like the Dietary Inflammation Index into multifactorial care. When that wraps up, I go on to discuss, in the interest of mine, the idea that in Ask the Doctor columns across U.S. newspapers and magazines, doctors are starting to field queries from patients or print queries from patients about MASLD or MASH, usually by saying, go see your primary care doctor and ask for an ultrasound. I suggest this is what I call a two-chair solution, since the primary care doctor might not be the right site, and ultrasound might not be the right request, but the increase in awareness is exciting. The group generally agrees. From there, we shift, and Michael goes on to discuss the emerging excitement around the FGF21 class. As he points out, recent studies from Akero and 89 Bio suggest that these agents are emerging as highly potent in terms of PDFF change and transaminase responses. While we need to learn more, he asks how this will fit in with Rezdiffra, and more generally, how long we can give a patient a potent growth factor, and what will happen if and when the patient needs to discontinue therapy. We wind up discussing challenges with adherence for an injectable therapy, with Jorn and Michael pointing out that adherence rates are low, but me suggesting that they might not be that higher for a daily agent if the statin class history is any proof. It's been a while since we did an episode with a guest where we simply talked about several issues we found important. So having Michael with us was great, and discussing these topics was fantastic. There's a lot here to think about in a lot of different topics, so just sit back, listen, learn, enjoy, and when you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group.
Jorn Schottenberg.
You know, from my perspective, there's still that's one of the big challenges in the to deliver the holistic care that you're describing and that Michael referenced to in his clinic at the beginning, because at so many levels there's disconnects between what the patient wants and needs and what actually the health system funds and the availabilities, time slots, and the personalization of the care that would be perfect. And I don't always have that. As a physician, we're trying to make it the best for our patient, but I think we fail in many aspects if we don't have the support staff. And that's, you know, at least in my clinics, not always available to the extent I'd like it to have. So there's still challenges to be solved. I think we're working on that, but you know, it sounds great.
Michael Charlton.
Yeah, I was interested to if alcohol features in that index. You know, when I think of not the clinical trial setting, in the clinical trial setting, people with above a certain threshold of alcohol consumption were excluded. But in the real world, that's not going to be true. So do we need a PATH value, say above 200, you shouldn't get resmetirom in that setting? Or should we look at that as a separate issue? Do people respond as well if they have a high PATH or alcohol use level? And in that index that you referenced, was alcohol included as a pro-inflammatory nutrient?
Louise Campbell.
I don't know. I haven't seen the exact part of what makes up the entire scoring system because it runs through data. But I should imagine people have to put their diet. And I would hazard a guess that alcohol is probably a negative and a pro-inflammatory. But I'm not an expert. And literally, it was just something I came across this week while I'm doing a little bit more around reading, potentially going into future of what we're going to be able to do when we manage this in primary care, because this is probably where it's going to go 5-10 years from now, given that primary care see the majority of these patients currently, and how can we assess? So it's just ahead of the, but surfing the wave, I suppose, and just looking at different mechanisms. But I think it would have to be a lot more simpler to put into a natural system. But I know if you look at the Beck's depression scale, you can have the Beck's depression mini scales, you can get all sorts of things that have been adapted for different use in different locations to give you not the perfect, but a working system that can assist the care. That might be something that needs to be done, but certainly I'm not an expert and it's just something that's new to me now.
Roger Green.
Excellent. Thanks. So mine for the week is very, very different than anything we've talked about so far. I have a service whereby I clip and scan Dear Doctor websites around the U.S. to see what questions they're asking, what answers they're getting. And I've noticed thrice in the past week, three times for those of us who speak more commonly.
Come on, Roger. You think you needed to explain that?
No, actually, it's just I never use thrice.
That's very old English.
Yeah, I know. It could be having the two of you on the bottom of this. I can't match your accents, but at least I can go for an occasional word. Where patients wrote to the doctor about having been told, the dear doctor, about having been told they have fatty liver, what should they do? And the responses were what I'm going to call two cheers. They said, this is a disease. It's been evaluated, a little bit about the new nomenclature in one case and the importance of understanding the severity of the disease and what it can do. And then in both cases, they said, so go to your doctor and ask for an ultrasound. And I was trying to figure out how I felt about that answer. Because if you go to your primary care doc and you ask for an ultrasound, I'm not sure what's going to happen. And neither of those responses suggested that anybody wanted to go to a specialist or as their primary care doc if a specialist was the place to go here. So I kind of figured that was better than what we used to get, but not what we need to get, which was my two cheers comment. Wondering how you feel about that.
I don't mind. So that's a great thing to be scraping the internet for, Roger. I'm impressed with that. I would say that one of the things that's interesting to me, we looked at with help the Optum, I think it's clinical care database or data marketplace. It's a 16 million patient real world setting. So out of universities and academia, and looked at ICD-10 coding for NASH. There isn't one for MASH yet, although they're interchangeable. And the extrapolation is that about 2% of patients with this disease have an ICD-10 code. And at the other end of the spectrum, of course, is myocardial infarction, where it's in the mid-90s, breast cancer, mid-90s, medically complicated obesity, is around 30%. So even something you can just measure should be in there. It usually is not. So, and MASH is at the far extreme, 2%. So even with a drug that's 100% effective, if you're only targeting it to people who are known to have it, you can only get rid of 2% of the illness. So I think our major struggle right now that we have effective drug and hopefully drugs in the future is identifying patients. So I think the fact that people are asking at all, I'm not surprised to hear that their first recommendation is an ultrasound, because only 2% get any evaluation or diagnosis at this point in the United States.
Voices from Europe?
I'd say I'm happy because they didn't say there's nothing you can do about it. It's only a bit of fat and don't think about it. So I take it as a win to get a rock to move down. We just got to move it a little way and then it carries speed. So yeah, I'd say that's positive. And I'd be more than happy if they turned around and said, oh, my doctor, somebody had told me to do this and that, because at least they're asking them to look. So I'd be happy with that.
Okay. You aren't any thoughts? And then I want to go back to Michael's invitation to talk about the FGF21s and some exciting...
No, please go back to the FGF.
let's do that. Let's go back to exciting future drug research, Michael. So take us there.
Well, yeah, the first shot across the bow from, I think it was Bristol Myers, was a bit disappointing. It failed in a substantial phase 2B. So I think there's some pessimism that there was either tachyphylaxis or drug antibodies, that something was limiting the efficacy of this class of drugs. And then we've had some success with other agents, including Akero's, 89 Bio's data as well. So now they're emerging as highly potent. They seem to be more potent in terms of PDFF change. Histology is not head-to-head, but PDF change is reasonably comparable, I think, between studies. So this adds 10 to 20%, I think, in proportional reduction in PDFF, good transaminase responses. How durable it will be, whether the side effects start to emerge when we get more data, who knows? You have to worry about bone density and things like this, too. But I think we're looking at improvements. And then how will this drug fit in with something like resmetirom? Once you have it is now a standard of care for this disease. And can you give FGF21s for the longer term? There's not much of a concern about giving resmetirom in the longer term, but when you're giving a potent fibroblast growth factor agonist, that may be something different. So I don't know. But the efficacy is certainly eye-catching.
You're suggesting something very interesting, Michael, that we mix and match therapies once more drugs become available, using them in the concept where you want to induce changes in the liver, maybe sensitize the liver to more susceptibility of other mechanisms. So the whole concept that some might mix better than others will be very interesting. And of course, we're going to look at toxicity as the first thing and long-term safety. So I think I'm aligned. It also should be noted that the route of administration, I think, comes into play here. The easier we can make it for patients, the longer I think they're going to stay on the drug and not skip doses. So that's good news and something to be looking out for, where we can actually do that. And I think we're not going to see that in clinical trials. So we'll probably have to figure it out ourselves in real-world observations, observational trials in clinics.
So it makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. One of the things we've talked about on this this podcast from time to time. Michael, you had something you wanted to say first?
No, I'm just going to reinforce what Jorn has said. The adherence and persistence rates for the GLP-1s is pretty low, about 30 to 40% at 12 months after first prescription and first dose. So injectable therapies, even when you have Kardashians and others promoting it, is still 30 to 40%, even with 20 million prescriptions written. So I think there are some difficulties that are faced by injectable drugs, and particularly when it's not daily. Taking a small pill with your breakfast is easily built into a routine. I think taking an injection every week is clearly less straightforward.
Even so, I remember back years ago when they were taking a look at 1 year statin persistence numbers, that those were in the 40s or 50s if you were lucky.
And now, back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page from which you downloaded the conversation, or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We're working on next week's topic, but it will be at least as good as this week's, maybe even better. Until then, stay safe, surf on. We'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.